Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 114. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And today we are talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians, episode 103, the third episode. We visit the Garden Gnome Emporium, which is, of course, Medusa's episode, a one that we've been really looking forward to, and I don't think it disappointed.
That's an affirmative.
Yes.
It did not disappoint. There's no way you could be disappointed in this episode.
Yeah. If you would like to reach out to us to talk about the episodes of the show or Chalice of the Gods or anything that we've been talking about lately, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, Threads, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Also, please join Prophecy Radio Reading Room on Facebook, where we talk about all sorts of books based on mythology, whether or not they have any ties to Rick Riordan. I want to jump right into our news and updates this week. So we're recording this episode a little bit early because we still have screeners, and Kristen's about to go to Disney.
Yes, I am.
So that's exciting.
I haven't talked about that at all yet.
Yeah, so. I'm really glad we got screeners. Otherwise, this would have been very complicated.
It has made life a little easier knowing that once I leave, we'll have the show commentary, like, ready to go.
Yeah, yeah. We are recording a little bit ahead of when this episode is going to come out, but that's okay. We have some news to discuss, and if we get a little behind, we'll just catch up later. But I wanted to remind everyone that Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief Collector's Edition releases on January 16th, 2024, which at this point is only like three-ish weeks away.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. And if you want to pre-order it, make sure you do so soon. I pre-ordered it already.
I don't know if I have.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah.
I also wanted to point out that Percy Jackson and the Olympians will now premiere on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern. We had a little bit of a surprise on the 19th when the show came out early. It was supposed to come out at midnight PST or 3 a.m. Eastern, and it actually came out at 6 p.m., 9 p.m. Eastern. And so I immediately turned on the two episodes and watched them, even though I had already seen them twice before, but it was a lot of fun.
I didn't watch them immediately because the boyfriend was very tired, and so I waited till he went to bed, and then I turned them on and watched them by myself, and then the next day I watched them with him. So
yeah.
I have now seen it twice. Now that it's
awesome.
Since it's come out, and we watched it twice, so that would make four watches.
Yeah, you're one ahead of me. That's all right. And I think it makes a lot more sense for it to come out on Tuesdays, because Tuesdays are blue, and I just feel like that makes sense in my brain.
Sure. Absolutely.
I also, by the time this will come out, will have posted both a thread on Twitter and an article on Subjectify Media detailing the Percy Jackson end credits and the monster notebook that we see. So I literally, kind of like we did on the podcast, but maybe even more thoroughly, you guys, I frame by frame went through and noted down everything that we saw in the end credits to see if it gave us any hints as to, you know, what could be coming for us, things we know are going to be in season one, and maybe things that aren't supposed to be in season one that could hint that, like, oh yeah, they're definitely already planning for season two, which we know, but it's still exciting. And then the monster notebook, I actually found a couple of new things that we didn't talk about on the podcast, and one or two that I think maybe we were wrong about.
Interesting.
So that was kind of exciting. So definitely check that out. I'm really proud of the work that I did with that. And then we are also going to have one of our fellow Percy Jackson podcasters write an article about how Percy and Sally's relationship is actually the heart of season one, not Percy and Annabeth. And I really loved that idea, and I immediately told them, yes, please do this. So look for that on Subjectify Media as well, and we'll put it up on our socials.
I mean, as much as we all love Persebeth, like, do not get us wrong, when we read the books and did our, you know, chapter-by-chapter forum, we noted often that the Percy-Annabeth relationship is literally just getting off the ground in the first five books. So it's not... You know, by the end of that, they're just barely starting to scratch the surface of, I think I like you, dude.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, like, it's not till book five that they're actually in a relationship.
Right. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's a gradual move. So season one is not going to have, like, crazy amounts of tension. Although I will say that Karen and I thought we saw some, like, really intense stuff on some faces in this episode.
Yes.
So, in the third episode here. So, you know, they're definitely planting more seeds, but it really is Sally and Percy that are, like, grounding the show, and they keep going back to it.
Yeah.
Like, there's every episode Percy is just driving home that his mom is the be-all, end-all for him.
And I mean, like, that's literally what is driving the plot forward, because he wouldn't have gone on this quest if there wasn't a chance that he could save his mom.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I am really, really excited to see this article and to read it. And yeah, I can already tell you I'm pretty sure I agree.
Yeah.
100%. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. The Empire State Building lit up blue on December 20th, which is always exciting. I'm glad that they did that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have confirmation that a documentary called A Hero's Journey, The Making of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, will debut on Disney Plus on January 31st, 2024. So mark your calendars for that. We will definitely do an entire episode on that.
Yes, for sure.
I didn't even ask Kristen.
At least one. I was just saying,
yeah.
At least one. Depending on how long it is, or, you know, if there's different sections to it or something, we may be able to even, like, go in-depth on each section.
I mean, you saw how we can tear apart a half an hour, 45-minute TV show and turn
right.
it into 2 hours, so, you know.
We're good at that.
Yeah, not going to be difficult. Teen Vogue has profiled both Walker Scobell and Leah Savay Jeffries. And I have not read these articles yet because it's been so busy, you guys.
It has.
I literally have no time to spare. But once I get a chance, I'm definitely going to sit down and read these. It looks beautiful. Their, like, pictures look beautiful. Walker already looks 25 years older than he did in the show, which is crazy. I read somewhere that he's grown from 5'1 to 5'7 over the course of filming. 9 months, and he grew 6 inches. So
he definitely looks like a whole ass teenager.
Yeah,
now.
Like, he's definitely looks a lot older. I feel like Leah looks very similar, but her picture that they chose I thought was really beautiful, and I've seen some really great quotes coming out of this. So I will link to them in the show notes. Be sure to check them out. And I assume at some point Arian's gonna get his profile too.
I
don't think there's any way that they do just the first two and
right?
not him. So,
like, come on.
Yeah, we'll mention that in an upcoming episode if that does end up coming out. And the last thing I wanted to mention was that Teen Insider has a video in which Rick reacts to the capture the flag scene, and this made it, again, I did not have time to watch this, but made it seem like this was him watching the full thing for the first time,
okay.
Or maybe he was just like, oh yeah, you know, giving background information or stuff like that. I'm not really sure, but again, I will link to it.
Very interested to get into that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Once I have a spare second,
right?
I will do that. Okay, let's jump right into our discussion for this episode. That was under 10 minutes, Kristen.
Bing, bang, boom.
We're doing a good job.
Keeping it moving today.
Yeah, because we have a lot to say about this episode. This is Percy Jackson and the Olympians. Episode 3, we visit the Garden Gnome Emporium. Everything that we've heard about their take on Medusa has gotten us so excited to get this episode. And I really feel like this episode, I mean, as good as the first two were, this one, like, takes it somewhere else. Like, it really, I keep using the word elevate so often, I want to avoid it now for the rest of my life. But this episode, I feel like, was a lot richer and a lot bigger. I mean, they're out in the real world. They're encountering monsters. Like, they kind of know what they're doing, what they're heading for now. And so I feel like this one is really propelling things forward.
They're breaching, like, now that they're on their quest, they're out in the world, they're having to look at what they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're seeing Percy make the adjustment from, I'm a human in the human world, and this is how normal humans would respond to this kind of scary thing or this terror thing. And then you've got Annabeth telling him, no, 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 why would we do that? Like, yeah, we have to do this. We have to keep going. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's that changeover. For Annabeth, she is in, I am on a quest. I know what I need to do. Percy's still figuring out how to be a demigod. And Grover is trying to keep them from taking each other's throats out. So it's a really different dynamic in this episode, but it's the start of the trio really starting to get to know each other and figure this whole thing out.
Yeah,
so.
And I think we see a lot more of Annabeth in this episode, which is a relief since we didn't get her at all in the first episode, and we only got these one-word answers really from her in the second episode. So we'll talk a lot more about this, but I'm really excited to kind of dive a little bit deeper into Annabeth.
Definitely.
So the episode kicks off with Percy inside the attic. I mean, as soon as that, like, blank picture faded into the attic, we were like, oh my god, it's the attic, which is so exciting because we know this is where they store a lot of items from around camp. A lot of the spoils of war can be found up here, and there was just a huge chance for us to, like, be able to go through and look at all the frames. And I will be honest, there isn't, like, a ton of stuff here that are, like, hints at what's to come or any of that, but,
at least not that we could see. It was quite dark.
Yeah.
I am interested, once it's on Disney Plus, to see if I can, like, lighten it up on my laptop or something and just make sure, but it was a lot of, like, general things.
Yeah. We saw helmets, we saw jars with things inside them that we couldn't figure out what they were.
It looks like a claw or something, yeah, but we couldn't really make out what it could have come from.
Yeah. There was some sort of stuffed head, which we know in the books, stuffed Hydra head, I believe, is in the attic, so, like, maybe it could have been that.
It looked kind of like a goat, which just felt sad, but we're not really sure what it was.
Yeah. I can't imagine the satyrs would be very happy with a stuffed goat head.
No, don't think in the attic.
But then again, maybe Dionysus did that on purpose or something.
He would.
Yeah, he totally would. There's some swords, some shields. The Minotaur horn is up there now. We get a couple of bird cages.
There's an old tuba kind of hanging from the ceiling, or we think it's a tuba. You can see, like, the brass, like, tubes that make up the, yeah, like, the base of it, not the big horn part. But we thought that was worth noting because it kind of stuck out a little bit hanging from the rafters. There were some scrolls, a bunch of old books that we couldn't make out any. We tried to look.
Yeah.
And some Grecian urns.
Yeah. So pretty standard stuff, and nothing, I don't think, that was like a hint or a specific reference or anything. But if we find anything, we'll let you guys know.
But very atmospheric and very cool.
Yeah. And we pretty much immediately get a glimpse of the Oracle right after, and she is so creepy. Mm-hmm. She was actually kind of terrifying, and you could tell that Percy was also not very happy, because as soon as she starts moving, he's just like, oh, geez. And, like, for him, it's like, something very bad's gonna happen right now.
Right.
And again, like, I'm so glad that we got this version of the Oracle. It's a lot closer to what I had imagined and a lot different than what I thought they initially were going to do. So I thought that was pretty cool.
We should know better. Always trust Rick.
Yeah.
He's not going to steer us
wrong. Yeah.
Like, I think we were just unsure of how much change they were really going to try and make. And, you know, we trust in the process here, but at first we were thinking, oh, maybe they moved her to the woods, and, you know, there were all kinds of things floating around. I'm really glad they kept it in the big house, because I think keeping the Oracle contained like that just makes it creepier, and it makes her creepier. And
yeah.
So I'm really glad that they kind of stuck to the book with this, right down to the green smoke.
I don't know why we were both so excited about the green smoke. I think it's because it's a detail that they didn't have to include necessarily, but it's, like, iconic to the Oracle.
And it could have looked kind of, like, chintzy or weird, but honestly, it totally worked for me. I had no problems with it.
Yeah.
I also wanted to point out the lighting in this scene. While it's super dark in the whole attic, there are two round windows on either end of the attic, and one of them happens to be perfectly behind the Oracle, so it just is this shaft of light that her chair fits in perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I just love the look of it. It just, you know, you don't need to focus on her. She draws enough attention on her own, but it just makes the whole thing work.
Yeah,
really,
it pulls
well.
Even more focus to her. One of the other podcasts tweeted out that they were also talking about the lighting a lot in the first two episodes. And I was like, I'm glad that we're not the only ones who are, like, obsessed with, you know, the lighting and how everything works.
Oh, yeah.
Also, I want to refer to the green smoke as a smoke monster, because that was a running joke for us on Onceable, which was our Once Upon a Time podcast, because they use the smoke monster a lot, just like the smoke monster in Lost.
Yep.
And so even though this isn't quite a smoke monster, and it does look pretty good, it kind of made me laugh.
Oh yeah, same.
But we get a vision of Gabe, which is kind of what happens in the books. Percy sees a vision of Gabe playing poker with his friends. And I did notice, by the way, when we meet Gabe for the first time, there is a poker table behind him.
Yep, I made note of it too.
Yeah. Apparently, in the books, the Oracle is the one that says the prophecy, but here, Gabe is the one to say it. And I don't know why it was so funny. I think it's because of his accent, and, like, it's Gabe. And you can tell even Percy's like, really? Like, why is this guy giving me the prophecy?
Right? The least mythical person in the world.
Yeah, like, literally. That is his point in this story.
Yeah.
But it was nice to see him again, really, and kind of, you know, bring that detail from the books. This is the exact prophecy from the books, and I'll read it out again just for you guys. You shall go west and face the god who has turned. You shall find what was stolen and see it safely returned. You shall be betrayed by one who calls you a friend, and you shall fail to save what matters most in the end. And we only get the first two lines of the prophecy during that initial scene, and then it immediately cuts to Chiron and Mr. D and the demigods that they've gathered basically as options for Percy to choose from to bring onto the quest.
I think it's Grover who calls it a selection ceremony, which totally took me back to Hunger Games.
Mm.
Like, it just did. But but yeah, no, a selection ceremony. It seemed kind of like official. All of the demigods who were like eligible basically were in a circle around the like this round Grecian column kind of separated area. And yeah, it felt like this is how we do quests. Now, I would say that none of the demigods there have ever been in that situation. So maybe this isn't how they do all quest selections because they've never had a quest, or at least they haven't in a long time. Because Chiron's been talking about how Annabeth is waiting for Percy, and Annabeth's been there since she was 7, so I doubt most of these demigods have ever seen a quest.
Yeah.
But yeah, just interesting. Kind of keep in mind for future questing, do they kind of handle it the same way, or will it be wherever they are at the time? That's where they gather people, and let's go.
Yeah. So the group includes Clarice, Luke, Annabeth, the demigod in a wheelchair, Chris, and other ones that we don't really know anything about.
Some of them whom we've seen before. I'm pretty sure I saw the one girl that's been fighting with Clarice.
Like the kind
of blonde-haired one. I'm pretty sure she was there without her armor, so it was the first time I'd really seen her without armor. And yeah, so there were definitely some that we've recognized, even if we don't know their names.
Right. And Chiron gathered these demigods specifically because they were basically the best of the best. So he wanted Percy to be able to choose from them. And he also talks about Percy specifically going to LA because they know that he has to go west. They believe Hades has the master bolt. And they say that the entrance to the underworld is in Los Angeles. And before Chiron can really get through his entire instructions and explanation of what's going on, Percy chooses Annabeth as his first quest mate. And this scene was so funny because Chiron's like, it's customary to, like, wait until I finish talking until you pick somebody.
Like, maybe you want to know their names before you reject them kind of thing. Like,
and, like, what they're capable of, what they've done, and stuff like that. But Percy's logic is so sound because he's basically like, we need somebody who would push me down a set of stairs if it meant completing this quest. And, like, do you have any doubts that Annabeth will do that? And Chiron immediately is like, all right, Annabeth Chase is your first quest mate.
Yeah, like the way Percy, like, lays it out is so foolproof. It's like, listen, I know that this is important. She's going to get it done no matter what.
Yeah.
She has no qualms about pushing me down a flight of stairs. It's so perfectly handled. And the look on Chiron's face is like, he's got a point.
Yeah. I love all of Chiron's expressions of surprise and, like, he's just, he has a great face for that sort of thing.
He's so perfect.
I was a little disappointed we didn't get some quips from Mr. D, you know? Like, he was standing there, but I bet there is stuff that they had to cut.
I mean, it's Jason Mantzoukas. Yeah. I'm sure they have a whole roll of film of him
improvising.
Yeah. So hopefully we will see that on a DVD at some point.
Yes, that would be awesome. Or in the behind-the-scenes documentary.
Also fine with that, yep.
Percy has to pick a second quest mate, and we immediately switch over to a scene of Grover shoveling poop in the pasture by the stables and stuff like that. Blackjack is there, or at least a black Pegasus is there. I assume it's Blackjack, but I guess we don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
And there are some Pegasi out in the field, which was really cool.
Yeah. There were, like, white ones and then some, like, tan-colored ones.
Yeah.
It was cool to see them all just kind of, like, hanging out.
Yeah. And I feel like that, like, they really could have just had the one, and it would have been fine, and I wouldn't really have thought more about it. But the fact that there are more there kind of reminds you how big Camp Half-Blood is and that there's a lot of other stuff going on that we haven't really seen yet.
Yeah.
And this is Grover's punishment for telling Percy about his mom, basically. Mr. D was very angry with him and said, okay, you have to shovel poop as your punishment. I thought there were some really interesting things about this scene because, one, the fact that Blackjack is already at Camp Half-Blood is different from the books. Again, if this is Blackjack,
right.
Because we know that Percy rescues Blackjack from Luke, I'm pretty sure, from the Princess Andromeda ship.
Yeah.
In Sea of Monsters, and he goes to camp and is in the stables and then becomes a bigger part of the story later on in other books. And if Blackjack is already a part of Camp Half-Blood, I wonder if we'll see Luke escaping on him later.
It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they could pull, like, Luke grabbing Blackjack and leaving and then Percy rescuing. I did think They did not infer at all that Percy could hear the Pegasi.
That was another thing I was going
to
bring up.
Yeah, like, Percy's there talking to Grover, and there are multiple Pegasi standing in the, you know, nearby vicinity, and Percy does not seem to hear anything. They do not refer to it at all. So either the Pegasi were just happily chomping and did not, you know,
they were busy with dinner.
Right. They were not thinking anything particularly strongly that Percy could pick up on, or maybe Percy heard it and just assumed it was, like, kids or something because he doesn't know he's capable of it yet.
Right.
So I was a little curious. I didn't really think of that until after we were done with the episode, and then I was like, wait a minute. He should have heard, you know, like, he could have heard something.
Right.
Either that's just a thing we're going to get into later, maybe that isn't Blackjack, maybe that's just another Pegasi, we don't know.
Yeah. I think it makes sense that he's incapable of that right now because he doesn't really have any control over his powers. Everything that he's done up until this point has been accidental.
True.
So he might need a little more concentration and focus to be able to hear the Pegasus, so...
Or maybe any purposeful use of his power. Like, actually focusing and figuring out how to use his power would probably give him the ability to, like...
Yeah.
Test all of the other ones.
Yeah, like, he'll become more sensitive to it or something like
that.
Percy tells Grover that he's chosen him as his second questmate. And this was really interesting because this is when we get the second part of the prophecy, because Percy says, you know, I want you with me, I trust you, you need to be there. And then we hear these two lines about how he's going to be betrayed by somebody who calls him a friend.
It's kind of a flashback to Percy in the attic. Like, we get the second two lines, but so you're seeing Percy hearing them, and then we're seeing him with Grover. Like, it's a little murky why Percy's choosing Grover. You're kind of meant to question Percy's reasoning.
Yeah, and you're meant to think that he's still mad at Grover for betraying him before, that he thinks he's gonna betray him again, and that he's bringing him along so that, like, he can kind of keep an eye on him, basically.
I mean, first of all, I think it's like, well, if you betrayed me once, it wouldn't be a thing to betray me again, so, like, at least I know where it's coming from.
Right.
But also kind of like a keep your enemies close. Like, Grover's not his enemy, but if I know who's coming at me, even though I think he's my friend, too, at least, you know, I'll have some way to know what's coming on, what's going on.
Which I think is really interesting and really smart on Percy's part, and we'll get more into, like, his line of thinking at the end of the episode as well, but I thought it was an interesting scene and sets up tension for the episode, because you don't really know how Percy is feeling about Grover, and you don't really know, especially people who don't know the story, they're gonna think Grover's gonna betray him now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of like that they did this. It keeps it from, like, just being... You're getting to know Percy. Is this Percy's way of thinking, or are we just thinking that because they've set it up to kind of feel like that? And then as the episode goes on and we kind of learn more about what Percy's thinking as he's going through all of this, it makes more sense to us as, like, massive Percy Jackson fans who are like, this is not, like, how this goes. But yeah, I really honestly love what they're doing with that framing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And then Grover ends the scene by saying, I'm going to pack the best snacks.
Yeah.
And I just love him so much.
Agreed.
The next scene shows Percy in the Poseidon cabin, and he's packing up for his quest when Luke arrives. And Luke's like, oh, how much money did they give you? And he's like, well, they gave me $200, which is, you know, pretty good. And then also these, and he holds up a bag of drachmas and says, I think they're Canadian, maybe, or from Chuck E. Cheese, I don't know. That was so funny, because they do look fake.
They look super fake.
Yeah.
I want the one with the octopus on it. It looked really cool.
I don't think I caught that one.
There's, like, a whole bunch of different designs on them, but, like, yeah, there's one with, like, an octopus on it.
That's pretty cool, because I always thought they had, like, Athena's face on them.
Well, my guess is that Athena's face is on one side, and then maybe there's, like, different...
Like, animals on the other or something like that?
Because it definitely looked like there was some sort of, like, face with a helmet or helm of some sort on there. I would imagine there's something on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Might have to look into that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like this is a perfect little quick explanation of what drachmas are, because we know that they're going to be important again later, specifically because we already know that we're going to see the scene of them Iris messaging Luke back at camp, and so they need a drachma for that. So now we know what drachmas are.
Mm-hmm.
Luke also uses this opportunity to give him the flying shoes, and we see him whisper Maya to the shoes, and the wings sort of come out of the shoelaces, and they look like flapping shoelaces until they form actual wings. And I thought that effect was really well done.
Yeah, they could have had the shoe, like, sprout this white, feathery-looking wing thing. I honestly love the way they kind of used shoelaces to create the wing.
Yeah.
And once it, like, starts beating and going like crazy, it just looks like a winged shoe. It doesn't really look necessarily like shoelaces. But yeah, so cool, so smart. I love how they did that effect.
Yeah. We also get a little conversation between Percy and Luke in which Percy kind of goes a little bit more into detail about why he chose Annabeth and Grover for the quest. And I thought he was being really open and honest with Luke, which is, you know, his bad. But it was interesting because he has put a lot of thought into this. He knows he's going on this official quest for the Master Bolt, but, like, his whole intention is to rescue his mom.
Yeah.
He's not being quiet about that.
No.
And he basically said that he chose Grover instead of Luke. He considered Luke, but he chose Grover instead of Luke because Luke told him that he would follow Annabeth anywhere, that he would follow her lead, and that he would always side with her. And so Percy couldn't risk bringing Luke along if it meant he wouldn't get his chance to rescue his mom.
Yeah. I also thought it was really interesting that you can tell Percy did the math. Like, I would imagine after they told him, like, you're taking two people with you, Percy started, like, really running through all the options. And, like, from who he's met at camp, from everyone he's seen, Annabeth is so clearly, like, the one to take. She's so smart. She's, you know, constantly just looking at her surroundings and figuring out the path to what she's trying to do. Like, Luke has been a really good friend to him. But after having heard the prophecy, I don't think Percy could take the risk that his actual friend would betray him. By taking Luke, this guy he thinks is his best friend at camp at this point, I don't think he was willing to risk that. In addition to, he couldn't take both Annabeth and Luke, and he had to choose one of them. So, like, I really love that you kind of get the whole picture here. Like, Percy really honestly thought about taking Luke as one of his companions on the quest, but math-wise, he needed to take Annabeth, and then just because, you know, Grover is who Grover is to Percy and kind of to the magical world, he did the math, and, like, Grover had to come too.
Yeah. In the next scene, we get the trio leaving camp's border, and Annabeth kind of falls behind a little bit to say goodbye to Thalia's tree. And Percy kind of immediately is like, wow, she really likes that tree, doesn't she? And you can see Grover's patience being like, yes, because, you know, here is the story of Thalia and what happened to her and the fact that Zeus was turned into a tree. And Percy hears that they had a satyr protector, but doesn't say who. And, you know, they were fighting off monsters and Thalia turned around to give her friends the chance to get past the border into Camp Half-Blood. And Thalia was turned into a tree by her father. And Percy just has a lot of quips about this. And when Annabeth arrives, when she kind of comes up to them, she talks a lot about, like, Thalia was a forbidden kid and she was the greatest. She was a great warrior. You're not a great warrior.
She is offended.
Yes.
Like, she's not just, like, informing Percy. She has no interest in educating him on what's gone on before. She is straight up offended in how disrespectful he's being toward Thalia.
Yeah.
He doesn't know. I mean, we know. He has no idea. Grover has told him the bare minimum here, and that's all he knows about Thalia and everything that went on. But, like, Annabeth is not suffering fools.
I kind of like this because Percy is being a little mean, but you understand why him and Annabeth don't really get along. He's really stressed out. He's out of his element. He doesn't know a lot of this information that they know because they've been around it for so long. So his defense mechanism is to be sarcastic and kind of mean. And when Annabeth says she met a hero's fate, he says she met a pinecone's fate, which is objectively hilarious.
It is.
But also so cruel.
Yeah.
After knowing the story, and the look on Grover's face where he's like, dude, did you really just say that?
Why are you poking the bear with a stick?
Like, Grover's like, seriously? It just, in this little moment, we get so much of each of their personalities and their interpersonal relationships.
You can definitely see Grover calculating, like, is there going to be a way I keep them both from killing each other mm-hmm. on this trip? Like, the way Percy is antagonizing Annabeth and kind of doing it on purpose, and Annabeth has no interest in being patient with Percy at all, despite the fact that he literally found out about this yesterday.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't know he existed in this world at all the way he does until yesterday, and she is not interested in him finding himself and figuring out how to be a demigod. She's on a quest, and she has things to get done.
Yeah.
So it's like, I want Annabeth to be patient and to understand that everything you've been going through for the past 5 years of your life, he found out yesterday.
Yeah.
So give the kid a minute to catch up to you.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, Percy's being an ass and, like, is not trying to understand what's going on either. He is being just as antagonistic toward her, and he's not asking for, he's not telling her, like, hey, how about you give me a break? I need time to figure it out. He's just poking the bear with a stick. So, like, they are both just so strong, pig-headed, and focused on their own task
mm-hmm.
that neither one has any interest in helping the other or figuring out the other.
Yeah, I love this because one of the hallmarks of Percibeth is the fact that they didn't start out as friends. It took a little while for them to get there, and then, you know, it's such a slow burn relationship by the time they start dating in book 5. So I love that they're being so antagonistic with each other right now. I love that both of them, they have such strong personalities, because when those moments come later, like, they've talked about the Tunnel of Seen Love a lot, because that is kind of when they really start to become friends, and they start to see each other in a different light. That's going to be so much more rewarding when we actually get to that point.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the other thing I really liked was Annabeth in this whole episode, but it really starts in this scene because she says more words in this scene than I think she did the entirety of the last episode.
For sure.
Yeah.
Like, for sure.
And she is being downright bossy. She thinks she's in charge of the quest. And, I mean, nobody's really going to blame her. Even Grover was like, I mean, did you expect anything else? Because she knows a lot of stuff. She's a great warrior. And it just makes sense for her to be the one to kind of lead. But Percy's not happy about that. And he wants a show of hands. He wants to do this democratically.
Yeah.
And Annabeth doesn't.
I love Annabeth's line there. Do exactly as I say and maybe you survive this.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's exactly how you expect Annabeth to take on this quest with this noob and Grover.
Yeah.
Like, Grover's not going to take the lead. She knows Grover's strengths and weaknesses at this point. She knows that her leading this quest is their only chance at victory. And Percy is like, I thought, like, we'd vote or something. Like, at least have some semblance of, hey, we're all in this together kind of thing. But, like, Annabeth is not willing to put the quest in any sort of jeopardy, giving Percy the idea that he's leading the show. Just because he's the one who got the Oracle's actual prophecy, just because it's his quest, doesn't mean anything to her.
Yeah.
And it's exactly how you want Annabeth to be.
Yeah.
Like, exactly.
Yeah. There's just so much more spark in her in this episode, so much more personality. She really pushes back against Percy. She's not sitting back and observing anymore. She's come to her conclusions, and now she has an objective, and she's going to win. She's going to fulfill that objective.
Yeah. Also, Talia's tree is just so cool. I know we got a glimpse of it in the one trailer, and that's pretty much the amount of the tree we get to see, but I love how they made the trunk actually look like her in motion, but it's only really that way if you look for it. Otherwise, it just is a tree. Like, it could just look like a tree with knots and whatever, but, like, when you get the right angle on it, you can see she's, like, a girl in motion that makes up the trunk. It's so cool.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to see how they move that into, like, when we actually see the tree do things in the future. Can't wait to see it, like, in close-up.
Yeah. So we see the trio head into New York City, and this is where Argus would have been. He would have been the one to drive them into the city, but, you know, they didn't have room for it, probably in the budget or time-wise, and bringing Argus to life is going to be a whole thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think we're really missing anything. It would have been a short scene anyway.
Agreed.
We get a reflection of the Empire State Building in the cab window, which I just felt was very important to mention.
Yes.
And they hop on a bus to head out to where they need to go. And there is a whole thing about how smelly the back of the bus is because the toilet is right there. And Annabeth mentions that this will help mask Percy's scent from the monsters that are hunting him. And there is no mention of Smelly Gabe. But if you're looking close enough, you can see the connection between the joke about him needing to eat more fruit and, you know, the plumber coming over, our friend Eddie coming over, and this scene here. So I think it's really interesting that they haven't actually, like, spelled that out. And I wonder if Sally will explain it at the end of the season. Maybe, like, if she doesn't end up killing Gabe, maybe she just breaks up with him or something.
Well, is it that when we learn it in the book? Like, we get the picture that Gabe is, like, a disgusting human being when we first meet him in the book.
Yeah.
But I don't think we get the explanation of, he hid you best, Percy.
I thought we got that when they were, like, supposed to be at, like, the beach.
Maybe? I don't know.
I don't remember.
I thought it came kind of toward the end of the book where Percy starts to have some realizations about just how much his mother has been sacrificing for him her whole life. And so, yeah, I would not be shocked if toward the end of the season we get a conversation between them where she really lays it out. Like, I'm not with Gabe because I love him or care about him. I deal with him because it was the best way to keep you safe.
Yeah.
And, like, I cannot wait to see how that is reflected in their relationship because, yeah.
Yeah, because we haven't really gotten a good explanation of who Gabe is. Like, we know that he's in her life. She's wearing a wedding ring, but, like, there's nothing in there that explicitly says, like, who this guy is and why he's there and why somebody like Sally is with him. Like, we don't get any relationship background.
Yeah.
So I really hope by the end of the season, yeah, we kind of get a little bit of explanation, if only for the people who don't really know what's going on in the story.
Absolutely.
So Annabeth wants to go get chips and soda for everybody, and Percy's like, I don't want to be stuck on this smelly bus. I want to go with you. And she's like, no, you can't. And Percy really wants to vote. He really wants this to be a Democratic election. And Grover refuses to vote, and instead he sings the consensus song.
Which is an utter delight.
I had so much secondhand embarrassment, I had to shield my eyes. Because this was just like, all of a sudden he starts clapping, and you're like, why are you clapping? And then he starts singing this silly song.
This is the best, like, example of satyr children, like, problem solving.
Yes.
That you could possibly ask for. Like, I would 100% expect that satyrs are brought up with a song for every occasion. It's, you know what I mean? Like, a song to solve problems between friends. A song for when you don't want to eat that thing you have to eat to keep you healthy. A song for when it's raining and you want to go play. Like, I 100% expect Grover to have songs for everything.
Yeah.
It's so perfect that he has a consensus song about how to get along with your friends when things aren't going your way.
Yeah.
And I want all the lyrics to this. I want to know the consensus song.
It's, yeah, I it does seem like it would be very useful to have. But basically Grover doesn't want to be in the middle of it, and Annabeth and Percy are staring at him like, what are you doing? This is really weird. And Annabeth ends up going inside the convenience store or whatever it is to get them snacks, and Percy kind of just gives up. And then I missed this the first time we watched it, he just sort of whispers, our voting system's broken. And, like, that was a joke for the adults in the room.
Absolutely.
So that was pretty great.
Oh, yeah.
Inside, Annabeth is getting snacks, And I thought this was a really, really interesting, subtle scene for her because she is super stressed out about what kind of snacks she's picking out. She has doubts. She keeps putting them back. And then she grabs, like, armfuls of them. And this is not something that she's going to show Percy and Grover. She is calm, cool, and collected when she's in front of Percy and Grover, especially Percy. And so the fact that she's alone and she's kind of low-key freaking out about snacks, you know that, like, on the inside, she's a lot more panicked than she's letting on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's the still water on the pond, but her mind are the little duck feet paddling insanely. Like, she is trying to keep it together. She is leading this quest. She is, you know, and she cannot let them see that she is just as, you know, nervous and scared as they are.
Yeah. For sure. And we get this, I mean, it's kind of a voiceover from Grover because we're seeing Annabeth, but he's talking to Percy back on the bus, and he's talking about how the monsters can sense kids, and especially the forbidden kids, like, they're stronger, they have stronger sense than other demigods. And at the same time, Annabeth senses this monster in human clothing behind her. And I thought this was just a regular monster, but you had a better insight into it.
Well, Grover starts talking about how it's better if you can identify the monster before the monster identifies you.
Yeah.
And so Annabeth is, like, being very, very aware of what's around her. And you can tell she senses a monster. And this woman kind of walks behind her, and she keeps an eye on her. And then we see the woman kind of, like, turn her head toward Annabeth. And she gives off, like, that Mrs. Dodds kind of feeling. Yeah. It has to be one of the Furies. It has to be one of Mrs. Dodds' sisters. It's definitely not Mrs. Dodds.
Right.
But you definitely get this feeling of, like, this almost, like, bird-like attention.
Yeah.
Like, she has that energy.
Yeah.
So I initially kind of was like, that feels like a Fury.
Yeah.
That could be a Fury.
And especially since her sister does show up.
Right.
I mean, it's gotta be that.
But yeah.
I thought that was really awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so I did just check the credits on the episode, because we're like that, and Sarah J. Southee does play Tisiphone, one of Electo's sisters, so we can pretty much guarantee that's who that person in the gas station was.
We can check that box.
Yeah. So Annabeth, because of this, kind of knows to be on the lookout for the Furies, and she immediately spots Mrs. Dodds on the bus, even though she's hiding behind a giant newspaper. And so she slips on her invisibility cap and sits down and starts chatting with the Fury like they're a couple of old friends who know each other. And I mean, I guess in a way they kind of do, because Electo is the one who attacked Thalia.
Yeah.
So they have some history.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
They're chatting along and they're trading barbs. I actually really loved this scene for so many reasons. Annabeth being kind of feisty with Electo, love seeing that from her. I love that Electo seemed almost reasonable here. She's not this monster that we kind of see in the first episode. She is quite reasonable. She is quite level-headed. She trades barbs with Annabeth, but she's also like, hey, look, we both know Percy is going to be useless on this quest. Why don't you just hand him over to me so I can give him to my boss, because that's what I've been sent here to do, and you can go on and do whatever you have to do. She's not even trying to stop the quest. She just wants Percy.
Well, and she flatters Annabeth in this little chat, trying to really just sell it hard. Like, you don't need him. He's just going to hold you back. You know, you're perhaps the most formidable demigod child alive. Like, you don't need this kid who just walked on the scene and is stealing your glory.
Yeah.
Like, let me take him away. You can just march him off the bus and I'll swoop him up and go. Like, no big deal. Nobody even has to see. Like, I love that Mrs. Dodds is using that, like, I can make this easy for you on many fronts. We can get rid of this kid and you can have your quest completely unimpeded by some other kid trying to steal your glory.
Yeah.
So cool.
And I also wrote down that line because I thought that was so interesting that the one of the top lieutenants of Hades, god of the underworld, knows Annabeth is one of the most formidable, if not the most formidable, demigod alive today. And of course, I think as Percy comes into his power, that is going to change. But, I mean, it really is going to be the two of them. And I mean, Thalia, too, to an extent, yeah, when she comes into it. But, like, I just love the emphasis on Luke calling her, like, the best warrior in camp.
I was just going to say, yeah, that, too. Yeah. Like, he called her out last episode and said, she's the best warrior at camp. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if that's kind of everyone's opinion in the books. Like, Annabeth is one of the best, but I don't know if people would have named her the best.
Yeah.
Luke flat out says it. So, like, I honestly really love that she's being billed as, like, the best of the best right now.
Yeah. And I love that. I love that they're putting such emphasis on that.
Agreed.
So, somebody sits down and Annabeth leaves quietly and Electo kind of knows, okay, she turned down my offer, time to attack. And Annabeth warns the two guys that they need to push out the window and get off of the bus. The other sister, Tisiphone, attacks, and Annabeth immediately kills her with her dagger. She's got some great dagger throwing skills. And Electo is kind of stopped from getting to them in time, so they are able to escape.
Something I noticed, I didn't actually say it out loud, but Grover, again, didn't sense Mrs. Dodds.
Yeah.
He pointed out to Percy in the car with Sally that he didn't sense Mrs. Dodds, and that's really weird. Like, he normally has no problem sensing a monster a mile away.
Yeah.
Mrs. Dodds has been sitting on the bus at least since Annabeth walked in the shop. Like,
right.
I don't know if she was on there the whole time, but at least since Annabeth went in. And Grover had no idea. So I thought that was interesting to note that somehow someone, I mean, I think we have ideas of who, is kind of shading these monsters, especially from Grover, or has found a way to keep Grover from sensing them.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that either, and that is so interesting, because not only did he say, like, he specifically said, that never happens,
yeah,
to me, and now it's happening again.
And both times, it was Mrs. Dodds.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just, like, any monster is shielded from him, because he knows the Minotaur's coming. Like, before the Minotaur is ever sent down, Grover already knows something is on Percy's scent. Like, if something is on the way and it's big and we need to move now. So, like, it's not just any monster that's not being sensed by Grover. It's the Furies and or Electo specifically. Just worth noting.
They do escape from Electo and the bus, and they're walking through the New Jersey woods, which Percy is shocked by. I think you guys already know this, but I will always stand by whatever New Jersey slander there is in literally anything, and I am here for it. And they basically stumble upon a satyr path, and we get our first mention of Uncle Ferdinand, who comes up several times in this episode and really informs, I think, Grover's history and character and stuff like that.
Also, you mentioned it during our, like, commentary, but I love the very, like, vague directive, like, toward the musical.
Yes.
With the New Jersey woods,
yeah,
and, like, all,
yeah,
of that. Like, it's a very, like, subtle reference to the musical,
yeah,
but I kind of love that they threw those things in there.
I just got vibes that,
yeah,
it was, like, this, like, it reminded me of the musical. Like, the musical just popped into my head, whether it was because of the dialogue or the woods or just, like, the tone of everything.
Well,
like,
I feel like the woods in New Jersey, the Trenton of it all,
yeah,
that they keep mentioning, I feel like that is something.
My uncle lived in Trenton, which just made me laugh even harder.
Yeah, like, I feel like it goes with the musical. So, yeah, I just kind of love that we get a little bit of a vibe check, at least,
yeah,
there. Because the musical was, like, one of the first adaptations of this work that Rick didn't necessarily, like, co-sign. He didn't help with it,
but
he loved it. Like,
he promoted it a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I love that that's getting a little subtle nod.
Yeah.
Here.
And Joe Trax is working on the show.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Percy and Annabeth are fighting over everything.
Yeah.
And Percy is, like, totally okay with calling camp and saying that they need help. And under no circumstances will Annabeth accept this. And there's actually no mentions of the fact that demigods shouldn't have phones on them, which I thought was interesting.
I really thought this was going to be the chance that Grover was going to take to tell Percy about technology, because Percy needs to stay away from technology now. Not just like, oh, it's not going to help you, we don't need to call people. It's like, hey, technology is just going to amplify your scent and, you know, make it easier for you to be tracked.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I kind of thought we were going to get that here, too, but we didn't. So I'm assuming we'll kind of maybe get a dose of that later.
Yeah. And Annabeth kind of pushes back and says, why are you afraid of who you are? Like, you're a demigod. This is who you are now. And it kind of goes back to what you were saying about, like, dude, you know, he's been here for 24 hours. Like, this is all new to him. It's okay if he's afraid, but Percy won't admit that he is.
This is kind of part of that human world, mythical world thing. Like, Percy stepped out of the human world yesterday. He is not used to kids get in trouble, you know, things go wrong, you just keep going. Mm-hmm. He's used to things go wrong, you go home.
You call your mom.
Right. Yeah. You get sent home and you start again the next day and you figure out what's, you know, how to work it out the next day. So, like, his impulse is, well, it went wrong, we need to call somebody and get help and then we can keep going. And Annabeth's like, this is a quest, dude. Like, this is, we're going to come across this again. This is not the only time we're going to come across something scary. Like,
and she specifically says, like, did you think it was going to be easy? It's supposed to be hard. It's supposed to help us prove who we are.
Exactly.
And it's so funny because Percy does mention calling her mom, and she kind of turns to Grover and is like, can you please explain to him, like, why this isn't going to happen? But she won't really admit that she's not as close to her mother as, like, she maybe initially appeared to be.
It's like, get your friend in line, because he's asked, you know, he's not on my good side. Yeah.
Yeah.
The way she talks to Grover here, and it's just kind of like, you need to inform him of what's going on.
Yeah.
Like,
and you can tell Grover does not want to be pulled in the middle, and he keeps getting pulled into the middle. He keeps trying to bring up Uncle Ferdinand and all this stuff, and it's really funny. But, like, kind of sad. I felt bad for him at the same time.
Yeah.
And Percy's like, why are you talking to him? He was my friend. You know, he's my friend. He's not going to be on your side. And he's my protector. And Annabeth says, he was my protector first, and you can tell that this really upsets Percy. And the fact that Grover never told him that he was the satyr who was trying to protect Annabeth and Luke and Thalia.
Like, it makes sense to us, because we know that that was one of Grover's, like, biggest shames, is that he wasn't able to get Thalia to camp. And, it, you know, he is really just trying to prove that he's not that satyr, that he can do it right, and he got Percy there. You know, Percy's mom got dusted, but he got Percy to camp. Like, he's trying to kind of bury that, so you can tell that that's basically why Grover hasn't told Percy the full story and just keeps referring to Thalia's satyr protector and not mentioning that it's him. But you can tell this hurts Percy a little.
Yeah.
It's just enough of a, like, why didn't you tell me? Like, you, me, and Annabeth are on this quest. Like, it was gonna come out eventually. Why didn't you tell me? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And it makes him realize, like, there's still a lot that he doesn't know, that Annabeth and Grover have a connection that is possibly deeper than what Percy and Grover have. So, like, he's, you know, a little jealous, too. But luckily, they are saved by the burger, because Grover smells hamburgers on the wind.
And this, like, as Grover is, like, following the scent, we get a shot of Arian with the goat legs, like a full body shot, which I feel like we haven't really gotten one of those yet.
They're usually quick glances.
Yeah, his stride is so natural, it's almost weird. Like, it doesn't look unnatural or CGI, even though we know it's CGI. Like, the whole thing just looks very intuitive, and I just had to mention it because I really love that we finally got, like, a shot of him as a satyr, and you kind of got to see the full picture.
I keep remembering what they said about his motion coach and everything, and I keep looking at how he's walking and how it's like that trip and catch yourself kind of gait. And it's just so, like, he's so good at it.
Yeah.
And it does look really natural and unnatural at the same time, which is exactly what you want in an otherworldly creature who's always been in this body. So, yeah, he's doing a great job. And they follow the scent of hamburgers to Auntie M's Garden Gnome Emporium, where Electo pretty much immediately attacks them. And before we get to that, however, we kind of tried to look through some of the statues and figure out what some of them were. So I know Kristen made a list, and we will run through those really quick.
Okay, so there are a lot of statues in this scene, and a lot of them are, like, smaller things, especially when they first come up on Auntie M's. It's, like, generic statues. Like, there's kind of one of a dog. There's some, like, lion, kind of small lion statues. So it starts...
Lots of cats.
Well, it starts out, yeah, like, she's trying to lull you. Like, this is just a statue emporium. Like,
yeah.
It's fine. Don't be alarmed by anything else you see. Because you literally take, like, three steps forward, and suddenly you see a sphinx, a cyclops, a griffin that has, when we paused it, it had, like, real feathers. The feathers didn't look like they were stone.
Yeah.
Like, the creature was stone, but the feathers still looked very real. There was a bat-like creature that had a long, looked like a serpent tail, but then when we paused it moments later, we saw that it actually looks like it has, like, tentacles that have... The top of it looks like armor plating, kind of like a snake, but the underside has, like, octopus suckers. Like, it was very weird.
Yeah, we tried looking it up, and the closest that I could get was either a naga, which is usually, like, a snake-like creature with a human head, or lamia, which is also a snake-like creature with specifically, like, a female head and body, and this didn't look like that, really. Unless the tentacles belonged to, like, another creature, but like you said, the scales looked very similar.
And you could see the scales, like, where the waist starts on the creature really matched the top of these tentacles that you see behind it. So it really did look like it was, you know, part of its body.
Yeah.
But it had this bat-like face.
I mean, it was very clearly a bat.
Yeah.
And, like, I couldn't find anything that fit that description, really.
So I don't know if we'll ever get an explanation for this, but if we ever were to talk to one of, like, the prop supervisors or somebody who had a hand in kind of building these statues, I want to know where this came from.
Yeah.
Like, if they don't have a name for it, fine. But I want to know, like, how they came up with this creature to put here.
Yeah. Dan Hanna, can we get you on the podcast?
Yes, please. We would like to talk creatures. I think that would be fun.
Yeah, awesome. That would be a lot of fun.
Another thing that we noticed, there's something that looked almost like wolf-like. Karen thought it might be lichen.
Yeah, that was the king who fed his son, who killed and cooked his son and fed him to Zeus, and Zeus turned him basically into a wolf. It's supposed to be like the origin of werewolves and that sort of thing.
Like
in that's, yeah, that's one of the creatures that I'm pretty sure is in the notebook that Percy draws in.
That we may have missed the first time.
Yeah, so like there could be a connection there.
Yeah, there's also a really big statue behind the bat creature that we didn't really notice until the second time watching, and we saw, like, this really long torso hiding behind everything else that we couldn't really make out, but if in the future we have time, we may try and see if we can figure out what that is, too.
Yeah.
For the most part, that's what we could see in the front lawn. This is just the front yard.
Yeah.
But again, if you guys see anything else, if you catch anything that we missed, please let us know, because we'll take some time and see if we can go find it, too.
Yeah, for sure. But meanwhile, Medusa shows up pretty quickly and basically invites them inside and offers to help them, offers them lunch, and says, look, you can either come with me, and I'll try to help you out if I can. I'll give you lunch. Or you could stay out here and fight Electo. It's up to you. And I thought that, like, her voice was so soft and kind and light and high, and she just looks both very mysterious because of how she's dressed, but also very welcoming. Like, you get good vibes from her.
She says, "Not today, friends. Not on my doorstep."
Yeah.
Like, it, you start to get the impression that, to Medusa at least, everyone who comes to her Garden Gnome Emporium starts out as a friend, unless you're Electo and you're clearly a friend. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there are monsters who know Medusa and who fear Medusa and therefore are the enemy. But, like, I feel like anyone who comes without previous knowledge of Medusa or has, you know, she initially sees them as a friend and gives them a chance to prove themselves before she decides that they're her enemy.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of fascinating considering how the rest of this day moves on.
Yeah.
And what we find out is hiding in her basement.
Yeah. Because I want to know how some of those people got there.
Right? And how did they choose, you know, what did they choose that made them enemy rather than friend?
Yeah. And so Annabeth and Grover pretty much immediately are like, nope, bad idea. Like, Medusa is not good. But Percy is getting those good vibes from her. And Medusa specifically says, we all choose who we make our monsters. And that's kind of a theme of her tale in this episode. So I thought that was really cool.
And also fits right in with what Sally said, like, not all monsters are monsters and not all heroes are heroes.
Yeah. And I also really wanted to note that everyone basically already knows that a forbidden child has been claimed. I mean, word spread very fast.
Yeah.
Once he was claimed by Poseidon. So Percy decides to go inside, and he pretty much tells the other two, I don't really care what you do, stay out here if you want to, I'm going inside.
And it's, my mom told me Medusa's story. My mom told me, you know, to trust my gut. He's trusting his mom and he's trusting his gut here that he feels like Medusa is not an enemy or doesn't have to be an enemy. And so he goes in for burgers.
Yeah. And Grover pretty much immediately follows him. And then Annabeth begrudgingly stalks after them.
Yeah.
Inside is a beautifully lit wood-paneled room full of kind of art deco, this beautiful decor. I saw, like, a Tiffany lamp in the background. Lots of lighting. Looks a little bit old Hollywood kind of thing.
And a very, like, ornate table scene. Like, very candelabra, glass, crystal, lace, tablecloth kind of thing.
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned it gives Hansel and Gretel vibes.
It does.
Because, yeah, like, all the candy and cookies and stuff on the table, like, she has all these sweets out, and you're like, should you be eating these things? I don't know.
Come into my home. I have all of these yummy sweets for you. Please help yourself.
Let me fat you up.
Yeah.
Before I turn you into a statue.
Yeah.
I also thought it was very, very important to note that Grover eats real food the whole time.
Yes, he does.
He does not once eat a napkin or a plate or a tin can or a fork or anything. I'm very upset by this for some reason.
Okay, here's just a thought.
Okay.
Maybe there weren't any paper implements. This was a fancy table. Maybe they were china plates. Maybe it was a cloth napkin.
He can eat a tin can, he can eat a china plate.
And I don't doubt it, but maybe he's been taught Seder manners that you don't eat people's good napkins.
You don't eat the fine china.
Right. Like you can eat paper plates. You can eat anything that looks disposable. Or if you know they don't want it and are fine with you eating the good china, go for it.
Oh,
but, like,
God,
maybe he knows Seder manners that you don't eat people's fine china.
Seder manners. I just keep thinking of how we named that one episode Seder Boudoir, and now we have Seder Manners. I'm becoming more obsessed with Grover every time we get something from him.
Each and every episode,
God.
We get something from him that just is like, ah. I love Grover so much.
So yeah, I do honestly hope that we get him eating at least a tin can.
Or a license plate. At some point, he eats license plates. Yeah.
So, it's gotta happen at some point. There's just so much room for comedy there.
Oh, agreed.
Medusa, several times throughout this episode, repeats the phrase, we're not our parents. And I thought that was I thought that was particularly interesting because, again, going back to the article I wrote about his monster notebook, I didn't even notice this the first time. There's a big monster with, like, crab claw hands. And this is, I forgot his name, starts with a P, Forcus, I think, or something, which sounds funny saying it out loud. but he is basically the father. He's like a sea monster god thing. And he is the father of Medusa. He's the father of Echidna. And he's the father of something else that we get in this season that I cannot remember off the top of my head right now. But kind of interesting.
Yeah.
That connection.
Mm-hmm.
Medusa calls herself a survivor instead of a monster. And considering the narrative around what happened to Medusa and how a lot of survivors of sexual assault have kind of taken on Medusa's mantle, you'll see a lot of people with Medusa tattoos because they're survivors. I thought that was like a really great line to include in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't like bullies. And that kind of goes back to what Alecto was doing. She really doesn't like bullies. And she even goes so far as to say that her curse, Annabeth calls it a curse, is actually a gift. Because now she can sort of take out the bullies.
Well, how does she describe it? It's something to the effect of, I never, you know, no bully that I ever come across will ever see my real face again. Or
yeah.
Like, something like that. Yeah, like, basically, I have the power to take any living bully and turn them to stone. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, once they meet me, end of the road.
Yeah, and I really like this idea that she sees it as a gift. I think that's very different. I think it's an interesting conundrum because she tells her story. And she talks for quite a while about how much she loved Athena, how she prayed to her, how she was devoted to her, and how Poseidon came inside Athena's temple and broke the silence. That's all that they describe it. They don't describe it as sexual assault, which makes sense. This is a children's TV show.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
And basically embarrassed Athena. And instead of punishing Poseidon, Athena punishes Medusa. So on the one hand, we get what is very close to Medusa's real story, you know, kind of PG down a little bit.
As Rick did with many of these moments.
Right. Yeah. But at the same time, the idea that she sees it as a gift, I feel like is really interesting because it was intended to be a curse. And so maybe this is Medusa's way of accepting her fate and using it to her advantage, which I really like because a lot of survivors, you know, talk about, you know, what they went through made them stronger and, you know, gave them a new perspective on things. And, like, that can be very helpful, but I think that there is also room for some people to interpret it as, like, she kind of accepts something that was, like, very bad, and it's almost like a naive way of looking at it.
Yeah, a little bit.
I feel like there's a little bit of a gray area there to kind of go in either direction.
Yeah, I like to think that this is more or less, this is the hand I've been dealt. I didn't do anything wrong. Athena had never spoken to me. I worshipped her. I did nothing but, you know, profess my undying loyalty to her. She never reached out. And then Poseidon steps into her temple, and this happens, you know, this thing with him and me happens, and I get punished for his misdeed. Like, how is this fair? But she kind of takes this punishment and sees whatever upside she possibly can. And, like, you think about, you know, the things that Medusa can't do now that her literally just looking at her turns anyone to stone. She can't really have close relationships in the world where she can be, you know, completely, I don't even know what the word is. Like, she can't be completely open with people because
right.
You can't look her in the eye.
Yeah.
And so, like, that comes with limitations, but, like, she's doing the best she can with what she has. Like, she's looking at the cards she's been dealt and where she is now, and she is making the absolute best out of it, saying, I have the power to take bullies down now. Like, this may have been used to bully me, to punish me, but I now have the ability to stop this from happening to other people. And, like, yeah. I can see that being the theme they're going for here. Yeah. Like, I like that Medusa's taken it this way, even if it does sometimes feel a little naive, like she's trying to hide and push aside all the other connotations of what happened to her, but, like, she's choosing, this is how I'm taking it.
I definitely like that interpretation better. I'm just very curious when everybody else sees it, like, how they're going to interpret that.
Yeah.
So Annabeth immediately does not believe Medusa's side of this story. She calls her a liar and says that that's not what happened, and that her mom is just, and that she never would have done it this way. And so it's really interesting because you are, and I mean, this kind of happens throughout the episode, but like with Medusa, we as the audience members are sympathetic. Like, we know her as a monster, so we're immediately on edge. And then we get her story, and we kind of take in, you know, her aura, and you do feel sympathetic toward her. And so it sounds like she wants to help, but at the same time, she's still turning people to stone. So I really love this idea that, like, they didn't turn her into a good guy, but they made her story so much more complex.
And, you know, as this goes on, we learn that Medusa is open to anyone being a friend, but she also very quickly decides whether you are not, whether you are or not. And once you are not, she's done.
Yeah. Like, the hat's coming off.
Right. Like, she makes a judgment, and once she makes a judgment, there is no second, there's no appeal. You cannot, you know, beg for her forgiveness. She's done. So, like, she still has that dark tone, that monster-y tone. She's just got more story to her than we, you know, than previously known.
Yeah. Like, I really love that a lot.
Yeah.
And so she doesn't really like the way that Annabeth pushes back, and she changes the subject, and she kind of says, oh, I think I smell something burning. Will you help me in the kitchen? And Percy goes into the kitchen and has a little chat with her, and she says Annabeth will betray him. And of course, we have the prophecy in our heads, so we're thinking, does she know something that we don't know? But she kind of talks about the fact that she's a daughter of Athena and the type of person that Annabeth is. You know, she's a lot more rigid in her understanding of the world, whereas Percy is willing to kind of look at the whole picture. And Medusa also says that his mom and her are sisters, targeted by the same monster, aka Poseidon. So she feels very protective of Percy. And as much as Percy doesn't like his father and doesn't like feeling abandoned by him, he's very quick to say, my mom never talked about Poseidon like that. And of course, we have that whole speech in the first episode of how she feels about Poseidon.
Yeah, she calls him brave and kind and noble. And yeah. So it's a very different picture, Sally's take on Poseidon versus Medusa's. And I think this just goes to kind of make Percy question more, like, who is my father?
Yeah.
Which is good. I mean, he's got his mom's interpretation, and he trusts his mom, but, like, hearing what Poseidon, you know, how Medusa feels about Poseidon, I'm sure it colors his take on his dad and, you know, may make him a little more wary of what Poseidon is actually up to in the world.
Yeah, for sure.
I have to say, this is where, like, Medusa basically gives Percy the option of, I can get rid of your friends for
you. I can remove them from the equation, is AKA, what she says.
I can have some new statuary.
Yeah.
And you can go save your mom.
Yeah.
And before she can, like, look to him for the answer, like, she turns around and he's gone. And I just had to say, both him and Annabeth have this flair for the dramatic.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, they are the same person. Like, as different as they are, they have some of the same instincts. And Annabeth ghosting Mrs. Dodds before she can really get an answer to her proposal, and Percy ghosting Medusa before she can get an answer to hers, it's the same thing. It's so, like, it's just this little, like, well, I'm not even going to listen to the rest of that. Like, I'm not going to dignify that with a response because I'm not betraying my friends. I'm not betraying these people that I need to help me save my mom. And so he ghosts her and walks out of the room, and that's when Medusa kind of, like, makes up her mind. Like, okay, well, if you're going to choose to be like your parents, then we're enemies. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. And she removes her hat and she sets it gently down on the table. And they're very slow to show us the snakes at first, which I kind of liked. Like, I honestly, I don't know how, but, like, I forgot they were there. Like, I forgot that that was a part of her character while we were interacting with her, because she does look completely normal, except for the little bit of, like, those gray eyes that we get in the beginning, which are very unnatural looking. But with her hat on and everything, you forget that the snakes are a part of her person.
It's like they're dormant with the hat on. Yeah. Like, they're quiet. They don't make any noise. They don't move around. Like, they are very much contained, and then when she takes the hat off, they don't, like, go crazy. It's not like Uma Thurman's.
Right.
They're just very, like, they're active. It's like your hair blowing in the wind. Like, yeah, you see their heads kind of,
and they're barely small enough that, like, yeah, it kind of hangs on her like hair, and I really liked the way that it looked. And I liked how they did become more active the more she got agitated and everything. I thought it was all really well done.
And they, like, yeah, they, like, kept her out of focus at first.
Yeah.
Like, even we couldn't focus on her because, yeah, like, at first they kind of tried to shield her. And then you get this close-up of her face and it's like, okay.
It was really cool.
So well done, yeah.
Yeah. So the kids run into the basement to hide, which I feel like is a bad idea. But, like, also, where else are they going to go?
Also, the first time we watched it, I missed that they left the shoebox on the table.
Yeah.
The shoes didn't even occur to me at first. Like, I know Grover, like, puts them on, but I didn't think about it. And then the second time through, I was like, oh, yeah, the box is on the table. Like, yeah. I should have known.
So it kind of hints to you as to what's coming.
Yeah.
And Grover does have a plan, but it doesn't quite work out the way that he wants it to.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, and he was like, when I say Maya, and then immediately flies off into this cavernous basement, which is just huge. And I loved the description that we got from Dan Hanna about them putting that together.
Yeah, it almost gives, like, Room of Requirement, like, big, you know, the big columns and pillars that hold it up. But, like, it's all built into the walls and feels like a cave. It's so cool.
Mm-hmm. And also, you brought up the National Treasure reference.
Yeah, as Medusa opens the door and she, like, starts to descend down the stairs, these flames race down the sides and it lights up the whole cavern just like it did in National Treasure.
Yeah.
So it, like, exactly. It was pretty
classic. Cool.
Yeah.
Loved
so
it.
So love it. Love it, love it.
And this is again where Medusa says, we are not our parents. But then she adds, until we choose to be. And that's when she decides that they're her enemy, is when they choose to be like their parents. And she calls Annabeth self-righteous. And she tells Percy that he could have stood up for someone he loves, his mom, unlike what Poseidon did, implying that Poseidon loved Medusa, that it wasn't just this thing that was against her will, that he loved her but then didn't come to her aid.
And again, this is Medusa kind of, you know, seeing things her way and her way only, because he chose not to let his two friends become statuary, that he's, you know, choosing Poseidon over Medusa, Poseidon over his mom. And, like, that's not what he was doing, but that's how Medusa sees it. So that is why she, you know, is now enemies.
Yeah. And even though Grover didn't really plan it, he ends up being the perfect distraction when she goes to attack Percy, flying by with the shoes on, crashing into a box full of stuff. And Annabeth is behind her, pulls off her invisibility cap and puts it on Medusa, and then points to where Medusa is, and Percy slices off Medusa's head.
So freaking smart.
Yeah.
And, like, Annabeth had to come up with this on the fly. When a moment came where she could put her hat on and become invisible and kind of watch the scene, she did. And it's just, it's so ingenious.
Yeah. It really is perfect. And Percy has to carry this invisible head that squelches, and him and Annabeth are being kind of awkward and nice to each other as they're leaving, because you can tell they realize that they just did something that was kind of a big deal. And, you know, I think they kind of know that it was a close one. And yeah. What they did together worked very well. Like, they do make a good team when they can work together.
Well, and it's like, Annabeth's wanted a quest for so long, and she's gotten one, and they're 5 minutes into the quest, and they've already had to kill Medusa.
Yeah.
And Percy knows that they've all been saying, like, quests aren't easy, quests are hard, and you're gonna have to, you know, and here he had to chop a woman's head off in order to survive. Like, it's like they both have gotten a dose of the reality of the quest all at once, and they're both being really just, like, formal and nice to each other because they're both dealing with the trauma of, like, what just happened. Yeah. And, like, okay, this is just day one. Like, what else do we have coming up?
Well, the other thing they have coming up is that Alecto is still standing outside. So Percy actually goes out there, pulls off the cap long enough to turn her to stone. She crumbles, and then he puts the hat back on Medusa so that it's safe for them to kind of have it around.
Yeah.
Grover stays in the basement while this is happening, and he's found Uncle Ferdinand's statue. And he specifically mentions that Uncle Ferdinand doesn't look afraid like the other statues.
It almost makes you wonder if, like, maybe Uncle Ferdinand was a friend and it happened on accident.
Or he chose that? You know, we know that Uncle Ferdinand was looking for Pan. Maybe he'd given up. Maybe, you know, this is what he wanted. I think the implication there is very interesting, depending on where they want to go with it. And because I just hope that this is not the last time we hear about Uncle Ferdinand, and that maybe we'll get a little bit more backstory about him and Grover once we learn more about the search for Pan.
Because, like, Grover, especially towards the end of the episode here, mentions, like, this is as far as he got. And, like, maybe it's not as far as he got. Maybe he got this far, met Medusa, went on the quest, couldn't find Pan, came back to Medusa, and this is what happened. Like, either he chose it and said, like, this is better than going back and telling them that Pan's not there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's so many ways this could have gone. So, yeah, I am very intrigued by Uncle Ferdinand and would love to know if there's more story out there.
Yeah.
Like, while we know that in the future, there's, you know, Grover is going to go looking for Pan. Like, if he comes across creatures that met Uncle Ferdinand on his quest, like, that could be a really cool way to kind of work his uncle into the story. So we'll see if they do. But yeah, I would love to hear more about what happened to Uncle Ferdinand.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm just very curious what Medusa's intention was here, because some of those creatures and some of those people probably were bullies, but I don't think all of them were. So why else would she choose to turn someone to stone? You know, like, did they make a deal with her? Like, hey, I'll do this, and then, you know, maybe you do something for me, and they didn't do it, so she turned them to stone. We just really don't know.
I mean, it seems like she very quickly identified what Percy and Annabeth really wanted, gave him a choice, and when they chose wrong, they were ready, she was ready. So, like, maybe that's her shtick, that someone comes to her, she gives them a choice, if they choose wrong, she knows what's next, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. Percy wants to leave the hat on Medusa's head and bury it in the basement, and Annabeth's voice, when she says, sure, is very flat. You can tell that she's trying to play nice, but she doesn't like the idea. And then immediately after, both Percy and Annabeth start fighting about these deals that they kind of, that were revealed in front of them, that Alecto wanted Annabeth to give up Percy, but she killed Tisiphone instead, and that Medusa wanted to turn those two to stone, and Percy cut off her head instead. And so you can kind of see that they, like, they're starting to understand that they can trust each other, that they're not going to betray each other, but there's still a lot of tension in the room, and Grover is over it.
Mm-hmm.
He is so mad, and he calls both of them out. And I love this because I feel like even though Grover does have these moments in the books of standing up to his friends and, like, being vocal about stuff. I feel like his portrayal in this series so far is so strong. There's so much more of him in there, and I really like seeing that.
Agreed.
And he's like, Percy, that hat is Annabeth's only connection to her mother. How could you just take that away from her? And Annabeth, how could you expect him not to do anything about his mother after finding out that she's alive? Like, you guys are ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then he says, you know, I don't want to upset anybody, but maybe things need to get a little upsetting before they move forward. And then he confronts Percy about what he's afraid of. And Percy admits to them that the other lines of the prophecy include being betrayed by a friend. And that with everything going on, with his mom gone and all of that, he just feels so alone right now. And his voice broke a little bit as he said that, and it was just crushing.
Yeah.
And the reason why, kind of circling back to the beginning of the episode, he chose Annabeth is because he couldn't imagine being friends with her. And that's why he chose her, because he knew that they would be friends so that she couldn't betray him. And he actually apologizes to her about it. And you can see it kind of like, it hurt Annabeth's feelings a little bit.
The thing is, I don't think Annabeth saw Percy as someone she could be friends with either.
Yeah.
Like, so far, she's seen him as nothing but a giant pain in her ass who is keeping her from moving this quest right along. Like, why is this kid fighting me? I clearly know more than him. Why doesn't he just trust me to lead this thing and to get us where we need to go? Like, it surprises me that she is hurt by him admitting, I didn't think we could ever be friends. Like, I get why she is. Because hearing that, even from someone you don't like...
I was
going
to say, if I didn't like somebody, fine. If they didn't like me, even if I didn't like them, I'd still be like, why?
Right. Like it's a human reaction to be like, ouch, like, thanks a lot. But, like, at the same time, if she takes a minute to think, she's going to agree, like, I wouldn't have picked him out of a barrel either. Like, yeah. There are so many people back at camp I would have picked over him. So, you know, I get it. But it does sting. And looking at her face as he says that is like, you can see the, well, glad to know why you chose me.
Yeah.
Like, that really works. Thanks so much.
But Grover does a really good job of kind of bringing this together and understanding where both of them are coming from. And he basically says, as long as we're together, we're not alone and we can do this. And I love the hope that he brings to the quest.
And this also clarifies why Percy chose Grover. Toward the beginning of the episode, we talked about how the show makes it feel like Percy felt betrayed by Grover and chose him because they're friends, but he's already been betrayed once. He kind of has that inkling, like, if he betrays me, I'll at least know where it's coming from. I'll see it coming. But Percy is very clear here that he chose Annabeth because he never saw them being friends, so she couldn't be the one that the prophecy was referring to. And he chose Grover because Grover is so close to him that there's no chance Grover's the one who betrays him.
Yeah.
Like, there's absolutely no doubt in his mind that Grover would not actually betray him, which I think also clears up that Percy sees that what Grover did at Yancey Academy was not actually a betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think he's forgiven him for that now.
Yeah.
Like, he saw, I felt betrayed in the moment, but I see what you were doing and why it had to happen that
and
way.
And I think Grover telling him about his mom wiped the slate clean.
I do too.
Yeah. I mean, he really made up for what he did.
Yeah. So, like, it's a very different motivation than the episode kind of sets you up to believe, but it tells you a lot about Grover and Percy and how, where things are and how Percy sees Grover now.
Mm-hmm.
I did add in my notes that Grover is the best choice that Percy ever could have made.
Yeah.
Basically for the quest, but honestly, ever. Like, for anything, Percy's made the choice to befriend Grover, to stay friends with Grover, to forgive Grover. Like, every time Percy has had the option of choosing to keep Grover in his life, he has, including bringing him on the quest. And Grover is going to be the understated MVP of this quest, and you can already see it in the show that, you know, it's being set up as demigod versus demigod, like, how can we work together, how can we help each other, but then you've also got Grover, the satyr, trying to keep the peace and help this thing along, and, yeah, I Grover's definitely already setting himself up for MVP status.
Yeah, for sure. I love it so much. Yeah, and it also proves that Percy doesn't understand how prophecies work, and, like, oh, I know he'll never betray me. We're such good friends. I trust him. Therefore, like, I've tricked the prophecy. Yeah. Like, no, it's going to come true either way. You just don't know from where yet.
Exactly.
But, yeah. So then Percy puts the head in the box and ships it off to Olympus. And he returns Annabeth's cap. And you could see how thankful she is for this. I think the way that she responds to this is very, like, understated, because she's, like, a little bit surprised and also really grateful, but doesn't want to be, like, effusive about it. But for him, like, he knew that that was the right thing to do.
She also thinks that this is a terrible idea. Like, yeah. Having her hat back, great idea. Putting the head in a box and shipping it to Olympus, not so great an idea.
They'll see it as impertinence. I am impertinent. I think I would have been severely disappointed if this line wasn't in the show.
It would have been really upsetting. It's a very important bit. It's Percy acknowledging, like, I'm not your typical average demigod, and I am not going to just kowtow to the whim of all the gods. Yeah. They can order me around as much as they want, and I'll go on their quests, but I'm going to do it the Percy Jackson way, yeah. And they can just eat it. Like, I love it.
Yeah, I love, it's not even that he's like, oh, I don't care. He's actually trying to persuade them that it's a good idea by saying that it kind of counts as a tribute to Athena because she had a problem with Medusa and now we gave them Medusa's head in a box.
Like, here you go.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, you're really trying hard for this. But yeah, that impertinent line I think is one of the most iconic lines in The Lightning Thief. And I genuinely think that, like, I would have been really upset if it wasn't in here. So thank you to everybody.
Absolutely.
Who made sure this line was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so Percy ends this scene by singing the consensus song. He starts clapping and he starts singing it. And you can tell Grover is very annoyed and also a little proud.
Right? He's a little delighted.
Yeah. And so the episode ends with a nice little scene that I don't think either one of us were expecting.
Nope.
And it's Hermes holding the box under his arm going up to the 600th floor. And at first he looks kind of annoyed. And then he starts singing what we saw it was called possibly like Arthur's theme,
yeah,
from a movie, and the line is something like between the moon and New York City, which, like, what's between the moon and New York City? Olympus.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks through the elevator doors, you know, presumably talking to the other gods and saying, you guys are not gonna believe this. Mm-hmm. And it was just really nice to see Lynn. I did not expect to see him at the end of this episode.
Definitely not. It was an added little fun bonus. Wanted to note that he's wearing, like, head-to-toe tan.
Mm-hmm.
He's wearing, like, a normal, like, delivery man jumpsuit kind of thing. But even his Converse are, like, tan-colored.
Wow.
And I made the connection to, like, when we've seen his cast photo, basically, where we got all those stills of each of the gods and, like, all the other superfluous characters. He's wearing, like, a tan hoodie. And it just, it's a, like, is that going to be kind of his defining feature when he's dressed as a human? Like, is he always going to be wearing this tan?
I mean, it was the exact same shade.
Yeah, like, it's very close. So I'm curious if Hermes kind of has this theme. Is that, like, a thing with the gods?
Yeah.
Like, are they each going to kind of have, like, a color theme? that they stick to or what. So I'm curious to see how they portray the other gods going forward. Yeah,
that was a nice catch. That was not something that I would have realized.
The only reason it stood out to me is because that stupid hoodie seemed so just Lin.
I know.
That I was like, why?
That's not Hermes. That's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Like, why did they let Lin just show up in his regular Thursday outfit and shoot this scene? Like, what are we doing here? And so if that's what we're going for here, it makes more sense. So I'm curious now to see how that all plays out later.
Yeah, for sure. So that was our discussion of episode 3. We visit the Garden Gnome Emporium. Very, very good episode. Cannot wait to hear what you guys say about it.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we really appreciate it. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas for episodes, or content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We do have some feedback this week. We've got some messages from Instagram and an email, so I'm going to throw it to Karen to find out what Tony has to say.
Yeah, Tony messaged us and said, just finished the first 2 episodes, and I think waiting for them since the announcement has paid off big time. I now need Disney to greenlight 4 more seasons, or 14 in one go, and we can get Heroes of Olympus and The Trials of Apollo, too. And I responded, like, 4 seasons in one go would be so historic, but so would 14.
Right.
Even more so. And I'm down for it.
I mean, I would settle for 10 if they don't want to, like,
right,
give up, if they don't want to, you know, completely, what's the word? Commit. If they don't want to completely commit to doing all of Trials of Apollo, yeah, as well. I would be okay with settling for 10 and maybe 11 if they do Chalice of the Gods,
yeah,
in there too. But yeah, I am so down. I'm really, really hoping that this first season is just going to blow their expectations out of the water, like really just make them so, so happy,
yeah,
that we will get multiple seasons greenlit at once. I kind of am wondering if we may get the season 2 greenlight a little earlier and then maybe get multiple seasons early, like maybe before season 2 starts or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm very, very excited, yeah, to see when we hear.
I had a random thought the other day. If Walker Scobell is too old to play Percy in Heroes of Olympus, what if they just cast Azriel Dahlman?
I mean,
it wouldn't quite work, but, like, I mean,
by the time we get there,
if they have no other choice, like, I would settle for it, although I would love to have Walker on board for that, obviously.
I mean, we have 30-year-olds playing high school students, yeah, all the time, and I like that we're starting with them around the right age.
Yeah.
But, like, they can kind of age them down a little.
Yeah.
It's a thing. Hollywood does it all the time. We can totally buy in.
We also have an email from Sword of Avalon, who said, hey, love the podcast. Always a highlight of the week for me. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's so nice. After listening to your latest episode, I'm now constantly thinking how cool it would be for a behind-the-scenes video journal series on Disney Plus called The Demigod Diaries. This needs to happen. Can't wait to hear your discussion on the show and the rest of Chalice of the Gods. Yes, give me a video diary with the trio and call it Demigod Diaries.
Right, like, how easy would it be to be like, okay, you 3, we want you to film on your phones,
yeah,
you know, here's your official Disney phone, take this, we want you to film behind the scenes stuff, keep it on this phone, give it to us at the end of the day, we want you to film, you know, feel comfortable, if you guys are gonna meet up somewhere and hang out and you want to film stuff, go ahead. We want to do a feature where people get to know you guys as people.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, I think it would help a lot with some of the the crap that has been pointed toward Leah. Like, if people got to really see the three of them together all the time and get to know her better, I think it might help some people to be less antagonistic toward her. But, like, in general, fans would eat that up with a spoon. Like, we love getting to know the actors playing our characters, especially because who they are as people informs so much of how they are able to see and portray the character. So, yeah, I would die. I mean, I'm already super glad we're getting the, like, documentary and that that's basically been guaranteed at this point. But, like, yeah, a Demigod Diaries thing from the trio's perspective would be so cool.
Yeah, I would love it.
Thank you for reaching out so very much. We love hearing from you guys. And we have some stuff from Twitter that we'll get to later. But we're very excited that you guys are so excited to see the show.
Yeah.
Next week, Percy Jackson and the Olympians episode 4 will be discussed by us. So you will get that in all its glory. And God knows how long it'll be. Because that's going to be an interesting episode. We saw the trailer.
Yeah.
At the end of episode
Although,
3.
That episode is only like 33 minutes long. So, which, you know, going to be honest, a little disappointed by. I really wanted 1 hour episodes. And
the fact
that it's close to half an hour, a little upset. But that's just because I love it so much.
Yeah. But it's okay. It's going to be okay. Look for that. Should be coming out on January 3rd. And until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.